So yeah, I think a lot of conversation needs to happen then between the brands and the factories that are working with them, because much like we in the industry have been slowly learning over time the necessity and the importance of being inclusive.
The Life in Motion podcast is brought to you by Actual Outdoors. They help build beautiful brands that highlight the approachable and authentic parts of outdoor recreation. Said simply, they keep it real. Learn more at actualoutdoors.com.
This is a Life in Motion audio experience, a podcast about travel, action sports, culture, and more.
What's up, and welcome to episode 186 of Life in Motion. I've got Andrea Kelly with me, who was voted by Outdoor Business Journal as one of 2022's most influential people in the outdoor industry. She's also the one behind Make Plus Equal, working with brands in the outdoor industry to create size diversity so that everyone feels welcomed. I'm excited to hear her story and how she's helping change the outdoor apparel industry from the inside out. Andrea, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. I'm happy to be here.
Yes. I'm excited to have you on as well. And I'm definitely excited to learn more about what it is you're doing. But before we kind of jump into that side of things, let's start off with, you know, who you are, where you're from, kind of what got you into the outdoors and kind of inspired in this mission in the first place.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, my name is Andrea Kelly. I live in the Pacific Northwest. I live in Portland, Oregon. I've been here about 30 years. I was actually born on the East Coast, and then my family moved to the West Coast during grade school. And I spent most of my weekends in Southern California at the beach. So when I moved up to Portland for school, it was definitely a different environment shift for me, and the activities that I participated in definitely changed. You know, I found it interesting that all my friends were camping and had all the gear and knew how to do it. I had no idea. And then I remembered why. Well, because I'd been at the beach my entire childhood rather than so learning. But yeah, when I moved into Portland in the late 1980s, started really getting involved with lots of activities that were available here in the Pacific Northwest, including rafting and kayaking and hiking and mountain climbing and snowboarding and all of the things that we have here. I think that's one of the favorite things that I have about where we live, is that the nature and the outdoors here is so diverse. I'm an hour and a half from the mountain. I'm an hour and a half from the beach. I'm, you know, 20 minutes from a river. So there's lots of accessibility for those who've got the transportation, at least, or people with a car to get out and participate. So that's sort of where I got my taste for the outdoors, was just by living in this amazing, amazing place. As far as my background and how I got into what I do, it's interesting. So my education is not in apparel. Even though I've been in the apparel industry over 20 years, I actually sort of came in through the back door. So not a designer. If I had to draw for a living, I'd be living somewhere else for sure. Not my skill set. But I got a degree in psychology, and then started actually working in the high tech industry just out of school, doing some customer service, and then ending up doing software training. So that's a little nod to how old I actually am, but way back when people were learning how to use computers and software applications, that was my role. And what's interesting is that's actually how I got into the apparel industry. I was hired by an interesting tiny little running company out here that most people know that has a swoosh as a logo. I was actually hired to be their systems trainer. So I actually came into Nike and learned all the tools and applications that they had in-house, and then trained their employees how to use those tools, even though I knew nothing about the apparel industry. So through working with those tools and meeting the people, that's sort of where I sort of got my head going on what the apparel industry was like and how it worked and so on. So that's sort of the outdoor background of how I got into it, and then sort of how I got into apparel from a non-traditional point of view from an education standpoint.
Yeah, that's definitely interesting, kind of how things kind of went full circle in a sense there. So you know, you mentioned kind of, you know, it wasn't until you moved to the Pacific Northwest that you kind of got into the outdoors? And obviously, you know, as you mentioned, there's so much, I guess, diversity there within the landscape, mountains, water, everything in between. When kind of when you mm-hmm. got into that, was there a certain like activity that kind of that you got drawn into, or are you more just a little bit of everything?
It was definitely a little bit of everything. Like I said, I had friends who rafted, so that was something we did pretty, I won't say regularly, but there was definitely an annual rafting trip that always happened, and maybe there were a couple on the side. I don't even remember what year it was, but I joined a climbing organization here in Portland called the Mazamas, which is just that. It's a climbing organization that leads hikes and trails and mountaineering, but they require for you to become a member to actually take an 8-week course with all the details and everything you ever needed to know about mountaineering, and then have conditioning hikes and so on. So mountain climbing became a big thing for a couple of years, actually. But yeah, not really. Like I'm sort of all over the board. Like if you have the entire smorgasbord, why wouldn't you dive into all of it, right? Snow, water, mountains, forests, I'll take it all.
That's awesome. And I definitely don't blame you there. I'm kind of the same way, although I'm in the middle of Missouri. So it's kind of flat with some rivers and that kind of stuff. So not quite as adventurous in that sense, but still awesome nonetheless. So what was it kind of about the, the outdoors in general, I guess, that kind of kept you or got you hooked? Obviously there's a bunch of different things to do, but was it more of like a, you know, did you use it to kind of reset and refresh kind of, you know, your day to day, just obviously enjoying with friends, those kinds of things. And then I don't even know if it, you know, maybe helped during those times, you know, out of college as you were kind of getting a career, taking some stress off and blowing some steam in the outdoors or anything like that.
You know, I think it's interesting because I would answer that question today very differently than I would answer that question back when I got started. So today, yes, I'm in the outdoors to reset, get fresh air, realize my space in this universe, connect with people who are like-minded. Back then, I wasn't nearly that self-aware. Seriously, like, who knew, right? Back then, it was fun and it was new and it was exciting. And, you know, being in your 20s and being able to stand at the top of a mountain was pretty spectacular, and it didn't really go any deeper than that. You know, and I certainly wasn't like a peak bagger or anything. I didn't have these massive goals that I was going to climb so many mountains or raft so many rivers. But just being outside and having new experiences that I'd never been in before, to me, that was the motivation back then. But like I said, now as I've gotten older, my career has shifted, my life has shifted. There's definitely a different focus. I still appreciate all of those things, but there's different meanings to the outdoors to me than back when I was a little young buck, just getting out for fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And that all definitely makes sense there. So you kind of, you know, work your way, eventually find yourself at a small little company with a check on the side of it in the apparel industry. I guess what was that like as far as, you know, I guess, you know, specifically what you were doing, I guess, was there a way, you know, given that brand to kind of merge sort of your love for the outdoors and sort of, you know, it seems like a bridge almost, but I don't know if it was a bridge between the two. What was that like while you were doing that, and maybe how things might have expanded during that time?
Well, part of it is that when I was brought on to do training, I was training all the different departments. So I was working with the running team, I was working with the fitness team, I was working with the outdoor team. So back then ACG was very heavily rooted in the division of ACG was heavily rooted in outdoor adventure and technical outdoor apparel. So I wasn't necessarily a runner, but I did love the outdoors. So the fact that I worked for a company that was building outdoor product was pretty great. I mean, I was the nerd in the house that, like, when it was time for new gear, I was the one who was always online and checking the specs and checking features and comparison shopping. So I really got into the detail and knowing that there was a division of this brand that existed, it was really appealing to me. And of course, anybody and everybody who participates in an activity has input on what the product should do, right? So the fact that I was in a place where I may had access to that channel to give some input to me was really appealing. You know, as far as the bridge goes, like I said, when I started, I wasn't working on product. I was the computer nerd who taught people how to use the systems. But in doing that, it was great for me to be able to work with all of these different teams because I learned a lot more about the business. But I also had the chance to establish a lot of relationships in all sorts, whether it was in leadership, different departments from development to merchandising and so on. So the role that I played in product development in training really sort of gave me a bird's eye view of what could be possible in working for that organization. And I think that there was the big opportunity. I think in most cases you come in and you have a job and you're very pigeonholed and you have your blinders on and that's about all you see. But with my role, because it was across the entire organization, it gave me a lot of visibility to see what my options were as an employee down the road.
Yeah, that's awesome to kind of have that. Those, you know, that different exposure almost with the different kind of facets of everything and, you know, long-term and want, excuse me, whatnot. So as that progressed, I guess, what were what was the next step in the journey after that?
Well, the next step was actually transitioning to the product side of the business. Like I said, I was really fascinated with the ACG department. And by that point I had actually trained most of that department's staff on how to use all the tools and, I'd had a really good relationship with the director of development and had lunch with her one day and told her what my interests were. And I knew she was hiring. And I said, you know, I don't know that I have the qualifications for this. I don't know anything about apparel. I don't know how to make any of this stuff. The conversation that we had was from her point of view, I was an easy hire because I knew how the business worked. I knew how the systems worked. I knew how to use all the tools. She said, I can teach you how to make a jacket. And I was like, wow, okay. I mean, I'd taken sewing classes in junior high, but that wasn't going to get the job done. But to understand that there were so many different pieces to what it takes to be a good product developer, you know, I didn't have the visibility at that time. I was young and inexperienced. And that's what ended up happening. She brought me on board. And I remember the first style that I worked on was a fleece vest. It didn't even have sleeves, but it had three zippers on it. And I was terrified that I was going to pick the wrong zipper because I didn't know the difference between zippers. No, they're not. But I had a really good leader and I had a really good team. And I think I ended up working with ACG for about 5 years. And like I said, I started on some really basic stuff and some knitwear. I worked on our graphic tee program. And to anybody who thinks that graphic tees are an entry-level job, they are not. They're far more complex than they seem. And then ultimately working my way up to working on technical outerwear development. So working on waterproof, breathable, fully seam-sealed, Gore-Tex, top-of-mountain type gear. I was lucky to work for a company that enabled me to learn how to actually build this sort of product, and not only build that sort of product, but also how to work with cross-functional teams as well. So, you know, as the product developer, I worked with the designer, I worked with the merchandisers, and learning that aspect of the apparel industry as well, not just about the product.
That's awesome. I mean, one comment I want to say just for, you always hear the thing, you know, if there's a company or a brand or whatever that you want to work for that, you know, might be large or might kind of seem intimidating from that standpoint, you know, figure out a way to get your foot in the door and then kind of build those relationships. Yeah. And then, build and grow that way. So it's really cool to hear how that happened in the first place. So, and this is one thing I'm kind of curious about, you know, especially from a large brand perspective, like how long did it take, you know, like once kind of you started and putting that input and helping design everything like that, like what is the typical like time frame of, you know, a new jacket, for instance, or like some of the projects you were working on? Because I'm sure there's a lot of intricacies that go in on that.
For sure. And it's interesting because one of the roles, and we'll get to what I do at Make Plus Equal, but a lot of it is actually education. One, educating brands on a market of consumers that have been typically ignored. But the other side of the education is educating the consumers on the other end who don't know the inner workings of the apparel industry and don't understand why they have to wait so long. Like, why can't I have that jacket now? Why does it take so long? The turn time on apparel, it depends on brands. It also depends on the technicality of the product. It depends on whether it's fast fashion or not. But the average turn time usually on an outerwear product is usually 16 to 18 months. Which sounds ridiculous. I'll also let you know that most often companies are building multiple seasons at a time. So they might be 3/4 of the way during one whole process and starting another one on top of it. And again, it seems like an atrocious amount of time, but there's so much back and forth. There's a lot of strategy and planning up front. It then rolls on to the next team who talks about pricing. It then rolls on to the designers who have time to do their sketches. It then rolls into product development, who is going back and forth with factories and getting prototypes. Usually takes about a month at a time. So if you see one or two or three prototypes, that's building in, you know, a large chunk of that calendar as well. And then you get into actual production schedules, and not only how long does it take a factory to make and ship something overseas to where it's headed, but where did the fabric come from, and did it have to be shipped from somewhere, and how did the fabric get made, and how long did that take too? So there's a lot of behind the scenes that adds up into why this apparel process, and footwear very similar too, is long. There's just a lot of intricacies, as you mentioned, behind making these products happen from concept to bringing them to the sales floor.
Yeah. That's definitely interesting. And honestly, your answer was a little bit longer than I thought. I thought it might be a little bit shorter, like six, eight months, but that totally makes sense between, you know, all the back and forth and everything that goes into it, especially, you know, when you have a dedicated and diligent team to do that. So, you know, you mentioned there kind of, you know, I'm kind of slowly directing us to kind of what you're up to now with Make Plus Equal. But you mentioned kind of one of your roles there was to help educate people about, you know, consumers that might being have been ignored, if I can spit that out. But how is, I guess, is that where the initial kind of passion for Make Plus Equal come from, or kind of how does that journey kind of slowly build, or how did it build over time?
Well, it definitely built over time. It sort of started at Nike. We'd have sample sales all the time. A lot of the protos would come in, and then they'd sell leftover samples back to the employees at a discounted rate. And everything was a medium when I was not a medium. So that was a benefit I never got to take advantage of. Not the biggest deal, but I found that as I got older, as I got more active, as my lifestyle changed, as I got married, as I had kids, my body started changing as well, as it does. And I ended up sizing out of the product that I used to use to do the activities that I enjoyed. So more often than not, I didn't have the option to wear the women's product that we were building and to wear the men's version. Not great, sort of got the job done, but didn't really fit and didn't always perform the way I needed it to. But as a plus size person myself, I just figured that was the norm, and I was niche, and that was the role that I was going to play as a consumer, is that I was going to settle for what was available and what worked. And that point of view sort of continued through my career. So after working for ACG, my family moved down to Southern California, and I worked for DC Shoes for about 4 or 5 years. And I also worked on their winter product there. So I worked on all the snowboard apparel that we made, plus hoodies and beanies and gloves and all those sorts of things. And it was the same sort of thing. Like, I loved everything we made, but I couldn't wear the women's product because it wasn't built to fit my size. What was nice is that our director would every year, she'd buy us a new snow kit. She'd have it in the budget so we could pick out from the product line of what we built, what style we wanted and what color we wanted. I could never buy the women's styles because it didn't fit, but it gave me the opportunity to pick a men's style that was close enough. But then they'd let me actually choose the women's fabrics, and they'd build me a custom one, which was great. Was one of a kind, but again, still, you know, tugging on things and pulling on things and things not fitting right. Doesn't sound like it would take away from the experience on the mountain, but it absolutely did. So again, going through those experiences at DC Shoes for a number of years, and not just even in outdoor, but even in regular apparel too. Like, I was always looking at the very end of the rack to see 14, 16. Oh, you don't carry my size. So it was always the struggle for me of, am I going to find something that I like? Am I going to find something that fits me? Am I going to find something that performs for me? And the answer most often was probably not. Where it really changed is when I started working for Columbia Sportswear. Columbia was the first brand that I've ever worked for that actually made plus sizes. And I remember looking at the website thinking, wow, if I go work for this company, I can actually wear the product I make. And I can tell my family about it. And I can tell my cousins about it. And to me, like, that was just a game changer. I didn't know that was actually a possibility. So that's sort of where the opportunity of, like, hey, this there's something happening here, sort of got started at Columbia. I started at Columbia. I continued my path as a product developer, as I've been at Nike and at DC Shoes. And I stayed in that role at Columbia for about 3 years before I moved over to merchandising. Merchandising and product line management, which if you look at the path of departments that handle product to get it built, merchandising is pretty much at the front end of it, where they're looking at business strategies and financial goals and coming out with a plan that's going to help the brand grow the business the way they need to based on what products they're generating. So as a merchandiser, I actually had a lot of input on what we were going to produce, what we were going to sell, and who we were going to sell it to. And I think what really changed it for me was information that came out in 2015 by Plunkett Research that took a look at the actual demographics of the population in US and Canada. So this entire time I had felt like I was niche, I was a one-off, I had to settle. But the research that came out in 2015, which is right about when I started my job in merchandising, was that 67% of women in North America were plus-sized, meaning they wore a size 14 and up. And I was like, I'm sorry, what percent was that? That was 67, so I'm not niche. I'm actually part of the norm, yet none of us can find anything to wear. How, why? And, you know, and the more I thought about it, the more frustrated I got. Like, why are we being ignored? You know, curse these companies that aren't building products for us. And why aren't they thinking of us? And then I went, wait a minute, who do I work for? Oh, I work for those companies. Oh, I'm part of the branding process. Oh, wait, I'm part of the problem. Maybe I should do something about it. So that's sort of what kicked off what eventually ended up becoming Make Plus Equal. With Columbia, it became a discussion with leadership about having more product available to suit the population who was looking for product. And it started out sort of as a side job on top of the real job at Columbia. At the time, I was managing our men's outerwear business, but then was taking on men's and women's plus big, tall outerwear sportswear on top of my other job. And it sounds like a lot, and I will say it's not the same. I mean, as a product line manager, I was working every day with the materials teams and the fabric teams and the development teams and the, you know, getting the prototypes and working with management. There's definitely a lot more to the product line management role that was my primary role. The role that I was taking as sort of the add-on with the extended sizing or inclusive sizing program was more of what's considered to be a merchandising role, where you take what's available in the line and then pick and choose and assort and build out collections that you're going to sell to your retailers or to your consumers. So it wasn't a full-time job on top of a full-time job, but it was definitely a little bit more work. And at that point, really, my goal was just to increase the amount of product that was available. You know, when I, like I said, when I joined Columbia, I was so excited that I could actually wear the stuff I made, but there wasn't actually a lot of it. You know, there was a very small percentage of the women's product came in plus sizes. So I could find something great to wear to a picnic. But if I was going to be on the mountain and I wanted the most technical pant, I was really limited and was still buying men's product. So my primary goal was to offer a larger variety of product so people could actually find what they needed, what they liked, what suited their end use. And that was the initial goal. And that's what I wrangled with for, I think, the first five years of managing that part of the business for Columbia.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I definitely understand, you know, kind of or can understand your point of for the frustration and everything that came along with it. But it's cool to hear that they, you know, were open to, you know, you exploring how to, expand that and giving you, because I feel like, you know, and I'm sure this is part of mainly what you do now, but, you know, a lot of brands, you know, with all the manufacturing and everything that goes into it and designing, they might be hesitant to that because they might look at it as, you know, I don't know, an extra cost, an extra step. I don't know the ins and outs of, building apparel from the ground up in that sense, but, you know, but to kind of give you that chance to figure that out, and especially with that number, you know, 67%, you know, from a purely business aspect of it too, that's a large part of the market that you're missing out on, also.
For sure. Yeah. I will say, I mean, a lot of people credit hard work, a lot of people credit luck and being in the right place at the right time. And I would say all of that sort of went into where I ended up today. You know, I'm grateful that I had the visibility to really get a sense of what the need was in the market, but to also be at a company that embraced that opportunity. You know, the founder, Gert Boyle, was the first plus size model that Columbia used. And you know, she was defiant and bullheaded and amazing and awesome. And I loved everything about that with her. And so I think to sort of push the envelope was sort of in the DNA with Columbia to take some risks and to try stuff. And but I think if I had learned the information I had and had the visibility at a different company that wasn't already doing plus sizes, it would have been a much tougher hill to climb. I'm grateful that when this sort of bubbled up for me, I was at a company that already understood how bodies need to be fit and how bodies are different and already had tools and processes in place to accommodate these customers. So I wasn't starting from scratch. I was just turning up the heat, really.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as you mentioned, you know, you kind of got, you know, it kind of worked out. Those frustrations bubbled up at the right time, at the right place, in a sense, to somebody that was going to be open to that. So at what point did you, I guess, kind of branch off on your own with Make Plus Equal and everything you're doing now? Like, what was that transition and kind of what was the, I guess, obviously, I understand the goal, but kind of your thought of like how everything was going to work and how it's working now?
Sure. So as I mentioned, you know, I was going to say double fisting my jobs, right? I had a full-time job being a product line manager. And then was doing, you know, the merchandising end of extended sizing, inclusive sizing at Columbia for about 5 years. And one of the questions that came up, even, you know, we were definitely turning some numbers and you could see the revenue raising, but there was a lot of question about, well, why isn't this growing faster? And I said, well, we're making more product, but have we told anybody we're doing it? Like, does marketing talk to anybody? Do our sales reps know it? Like, if you can say if you build it, they will come, but they will only come if you tell them you built it, and they will only come if you involve them in the conversation. So, you know, being in two positions, I didn't really have the opportunity to do all of that. I could say, here are the collections, here are the people, you know, I can talk to consumers and figure out what we need. But as far as the rest of the go-to-market stuff, that just, there was no room in my role to do that. So in 2020, we had a reorganization and they actually built out my dream job, yay, which was to manage wholly and entirely the extended sizes or inclusive sizes business. So they actually took me off of product. I was no longer a product line manager. I built a box on the org chart that had never been there before. And it was like, wait, where am I? Oh, I'm over there now. Oh, what is that? You know, and I won't say I had free reign, but I said, you know, tell me what our goals are, what our targets are, what are you looking for? And my leader at the time basically said, you tell us what you think we should do and we'll see what we can do about it.
Wow.
It was great. So for 3 years, then I had the opportunity to not only work on the pieces that I had been doing, sort of on the side, but then finally having a chance to talk to our retail marketing team about what store environments should look like and how to make them feel like more people belong. And working with the e-com team on some of the projects, they were fine-tuning towards a broader customer base, and working with our social media team and engaging with influencers and really blowing out that go-to-market piece of it, which really, I think, I'm not saying full credit. I mean, it was me. I was one person knocking on a bunch of doors. The beauty is so many people opened up the doors and said, yeah, let's do this. So it was really, really great that the people that I worked with were so excited and interested and committed to actually making the programs work. It was great. And I love all of those people. They were fantastic to work with. So things got rolling. They really picked up. I think with any of the social media projects that we did, Any engagement that was focused on inclusive sizes far outblasted any KPIs and any targets and any benchmarks that they had, because consumers were so excited and happy that somebody was finally listening and learning and understanding and reaching out. And it was so, so rewarding in so many facets. So I did that for about 3 years. And then back to your question about how did Make Plus Equal start. So I got to go back to 2015 when I first approached leadership and said, here's an opportunity. We're missing all these people. because I was part of the industry, my goal at that point was to change the industry from the inside out. Like, who better to fix this than somebody who's already on the inside of an apparel company? Like I said, I was in the right place at the right time. But for me, it was always about choice. I wanted to make us more size inclusive. I wanted to grow the business because I wanted more people to have more choice. I wanted people to have equal opportunity regardless of how they were built. So for me, being at Columbia was fantastic. I'm so glad I did that. But I knew that doing it one brand at a time wasn't going to give us enough choice, right? Like, I knew I could wear Columbia product if I needed to, but what if I sized out of it? Okay, well, there's another brand who does it. Well, what if I don't like their colors that season? Okay, well, there's one more brand that makes plus, but what if the fit model that they used, even though the measurements are same, the body type doesn't match my body type, their product's going to fit me. Well, now what? You know, we were still so very limited in availability of product from a variety of brands that I knew that if I stayed in-house, I wasn't going to have as big of an impact as I would if I were to walk away from a brand and then continue working with other brands outside of that business within the industry to give more brands the opportunity to add inclusion, which would then ultimately give more people more choice. And that's how I got to where I am.
Yeah. And that makes sense to me, you know, work from the inside out to that sense. You know, obviously, you know, you're probably a little bit easier to make your voice be heard in that sense. So now is it, you know, what, and are you still, I guess, is Make Plus Equal, is that kind of the only thing you're doing now? Is it kind of going into various brands in that sense and kind of helping build out these products or processes or whatnot, or kind of what does that fully look like? Or is that still kind of like a subcategory of something else?
No, it is the whole meal deal. That is the entire focus of Make Plus Equal, is to work with outdoor apparel brands or outdoor related. You know, I'm working with some brands in the running field as well. Anything that gets you outside to do the things that you want to do, I want to help brands make that available to people in larger bodies. So yeah, that's the focus, is to work with brands and help them anywhere along that spectrum of building product, whether it's brand strategy, product strategy, from the merchandising standpoint, whether it's assortments and figuring out what product they need to make, how to engage with the customer to make sure they're building the right product. From a development point of view, it's conversations about fit, it's conversations about construction and things to keep in mind as you're considering larger body people. It's pricing, which is a big conversation around plus size product because it costs more to make. So everything on the product development side, and then even into working with sales teams, working with sales reps on the retail floor to understand how to become more well-versed at a more diverse community of customers that may be coming into the stores, and then anything go-to-market related, whether it's helping social media teams use the right language or connecting them with influencers who work in these spaces, again, to working with e-com teams to make their sites more shoppable for people of size, and so on and so on. So it's the whole gamut of everything from the product building process.
Yeah. The whole shebang there. So once you kind of expanded out, I mean, did you find that a lot of, you know, of the brands, you know, that you began working with, you know, outside of Columbia and everything like that, were they pretty open to the idea of kind of that expansion part of, you know, part of their business from their sense, or is there still, it seems like the apparel industry in a whole is sort of, you know, kind of lending into that, which is good to hear. But yeah, I'm just curious, like, if there was a lot of openness in that sense, you know, as that expansion began.
I'm going to answer it a little bit differently, because one of the things that I really focus on with my brand is to focus with the companies that are really ready to do it. You know, I've spent many, many years fighting the fight, showing the reasons, raising the flags, convincing, and it's a tough battle to fight sometimes. I'm here for the folks who are ready to do it. Like, they've done the research, they know it's important, they're committed. You know, it's not performative. They're really in it to win it and serve a consumer base. So in that case, yes, but that's because I'm barking up the trees I want to be barking up, frankly.
Yeah. And then also, I'm curious, you know, kind of the other end of this, or I guess not the other end, the main part of it is the consumer. But from like a consumer mm-hmm. standpoint, you know, everybody, you know, we talk about diversity in many different ways in the outdoors, whether it be, you know, color or, you know, sexual preference, all those different things. But I feel like one thing, you know, can be talked about this, the size or overlooked, I guess, in that sense. And it's, and it seems to me thinking about it, you know, it's something where it's kind of the same thing. You know, if you don't see somebody that looks like you doing that activity, then that might not give you the confidence to go out there and try that activity. In that sense, kind of being able to expand something like, you know, a jacket or snow pants or whatever that might be that fit comfortably, feel good. Do you think that in a sense is helping others kind of get or be more willing to try outdoor activities or get into outdoor activities rather than kind of having that barrier, I guess, in that sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's a couple things I want to speak to with that. I've spent a lot of time in the last month or so thinking about welcoming people, feeling welcome in spaces. And I had the opportunity to speak on a panel about inclusion last month, in Austin at the running event. And I was on a panel with Martinez Evans, who's the Slow AF Run Club guy. So he speaks about inclusion from a a BIPOC standpoint and from a size standpoint. Michael Clemens was also on the panel. And is, I believe he's the director of the Queer Running Society. So between ethnicity and size and sexual identity and so on, like we sort of covered the gambit and we talked a lot about customers feeling welcome in spaces. And the more I thought about the term welcome, it kind of started not sitting right with me. To me, I think welcome sounds like you're a plus one on an invite.
Yeah.
Like you can come, you know? And so I've actually been thinking more about belonging more than feeling welcome. Like I'm supposed to be here. This is the spot. This is where I'm supposed to be. My opinions are valued. What I do is important and all of that. So I think about being in spaces and not feeling recognized or not feeling like I belong, whether it's not seeing people like me on the mountain, which has definitely changed. You know, not seeing things available for me in store, not seeing imagery available to me in store. And I remember early on having a conversation with somebody who said, "So you mean to tell me that because that image up there is of somebody thin, you wouldn't buy that product?" I said, "Well, I mean, I'm going to buy the tools that I need, but that image tells me far more about the brand than it tells me about the product they're selling. It tells me that I'm supposed to belong, that they want me as part of their story. I am of value to them." So I think a lot more about making sure people not only just feel like they're included, but they're supposed to be there in the first place. I think the other challenging piece of all of this is this conversation from brands who are hesitant to go into these spaces and start serving these consumers that they haven't before. You know, a lot of the pushback has always been, well, you know, to the point you raised, well, we don't see people, quote unquote, like you, like them, doing those activities. So if we don't see plus size people skiing, then why would we make plus size product? Well, if you don't make the product, then they'll never be outside for you to see them in.
Because yeah, they don't catch have 22. Anything
to wear. So they exactly like they're their own roadblock, right? Like again, if you build it and you tell them and you engage them in it, they will come. So I think that's starting to shift. And I'm seeing more and more brands working on their marketing. And, you know, I go to the website and you see people of all sizes together. Or, you know, I remember the day that not just externally facing, but internally facing, Columbia gave us our annual medical package where you could sign up for all your benefits. And the cover of the benefits catalog was completely inclusive from size, from ethnicity. I was like, look at this, like this matters to us now. It's not just an outwardly facing thing that we're working on being inclusive. It's one of the values of the company. Like everybody should be valued and respected and treated equally. So I think I danced around a lot of what you asked me, but I think I covered.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I like your viewpoint and the explanation between, welcomed and belonging or welcoming and belonging or belong, you know what I'm trying to say? Cause that mm-hmm. does make sense. And it's, yeah, you know, there's definitely, you know, I feel like a lot of people will see, you know, companies or brands do one thing and like, oh, they're just doing that to check a box or whatever that might be. But there is, from a consumer standpoint, there is, you know, a psychological aspect to it, to seeing that kind of stuff, that, you know, in a positive way, of course, that does matter. And that continues to kind of, you know, build whatever that is, whether it be in outdoors or whatnot as well. So, you know, it's cool that, you know, especially you being close, you know, really into the outdoor industry in that realm of things, kind of seeing that shift and that change, kind of, you know, start to take place and, you know, make an impact.
Yeah. Again, timing was great. Location, you know, being in the right spot at the right time, it really made a difference for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And so before we wrap this up, is there anything that we might not have covered that we should have?
I think we touched on some of the big stuff. Like, we talked about the percentages. We talked about 67% of women being plus sized in North America. CDC came out in, I think, 2018 with stats on the male consumer, that 70% of men are considered in the big and tall category. So again, it's the majority of the population. We know we're not getting smaller as a people. A lot of organizations who fear that an investment here might be a trend, it's kind of the reality. It's sort of where we are. It's not going away. I know there was a lot of pushback from New York Fashion Week and Paris Fashion Week the last year or so, where, you know, a few years ago, they were actually becoming more inclusive on the runway and larger models, and that dialed back. So I think people seeing them come back and going back to those straighter, thinner body types are sort of raising some flags of like, oh, has plus size passed? No, we're all still here. The fashion industry may think it's past, right? Media may think it's past, but we all still live here and we all still want to get on and participate and do things. I think we touched on the business and, you know, the opportunities available and working through Make Plus Equal, as well as the partnerships with consumers that I've met over the many years and through all the websites and all the boards. And I think folks are really excited to see the change happening. If I'm honest, I actually thought about launching this thing before the pandemic, and, you know, life changed. And I was worried that when I launched this past year that I had missed the wave, and, you know, so many brands were already getting started, and that's not true. Yeah, there's some brands that have really been working on it well and have done a really good job, but there's so much opportunity for so many more brands to come to the table and start thinking broader. So I'm grateful for that. And again, my goal is to give people as much choice as the next guy. So they have access to not settle anymore, to choose what they need, what they want, what suits them, what's in their price range. And that's the trajectory I'm headed on with Make Plus Equal, to make sure that everybody has equal access to what they need to do the things they love.
Absolutely. I love that. So one thing I always like to ask is kind of one piece of advice for our listeners. And I'm kind of taking this in a little bit of is sort of in a general sense, but also from an apparel sense as well. What can smaller brands do to kind of help kind of with what you're doing? For instance, especially given, you know, for example, if they're not manufacturing, you know, the t-shirts or the hoodies or whatever that is themselves, and they're using blank apparel to print their designs, stuff like that, you know, there's limitations as far as, you know, inventories and on different sizes and colors on different sizes and all those various things. And, you know, not having the resource to, you know, have your own factory to do that, such as some of the larger brands. What would your suggestion be, I guess, you know, simplest way to kind of, you know, work towards that while having sort of those business limitations at the same time?
That's a really good question. And it's interesting you bring that up, because I'm seeing that with some of the brands I'm working with. I mean, some of them are very large scale companies who have access to all the suppliers you can imagine, and some are very limited. You know, it's really hard to take, you know, 1,000 unit order and break it out into 12 sizes instead of breaking it out into 9 sizes. I think a lot of conversation needs to happen then between the brands and the factories that are working with them, because much like we in the industry have been slowly learning over time the necessity and the importance of being inclusive. And not only that, from a doing the right thing and serving the people well, but I mean, people are leaving money on the table, right? There are folks out here who are not being served, who are ready to hand over their money to a brand who's ready to pay attention to them. So while we're working on having those conversations here with brands to get them to understand and adopt those thought processes, that then needs to respond down to the supply chain as well, right? Factories who don't understand why it's important to build larger sizes, they don't have visibility necessarily to what's happening in our marketplace. I think that's probably the first step, is to start building out education that way as well.
Yeah,
you got to show them the why. The why is always the answer.
You know, you're right. You're right there, and I think that's great advice. So, to that point, where can people find you online to get in touch, or resources, or anything like that, if they're interested?
They can start at the website. They can go to makeplusequal.com. It's all spelled out, no symbols. Just makeplusequal.com, and then on Instagram, I'm at makeplusequal.com, and
awesome.
I'm on LinkedIn. There's a makeplusequal. There's a Make Plus Equal page, and then there's also my page on LinkedIn, Andrea Kelly.
Awesome. Well, definitely make sure to check those out. You know, I love what you're doing for the industry, and kind of, you know, changing those perspectives, even though, you know, there's, you know, figuring out how to decrease some of those limitations from a larger scale. But it sounds like you're making headways, and ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, the, as we kind of discussed, you know, the more people that feel comfortable in what they're wearing outside, the more people that get outside and experience those activities, which is what we want anyway. So I appreciate all that you're doing, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks for listening. And hey, if you've made it this far and like what you've heard, go ahead and hit that subscribe button and let your friends know about Life in Motion. Until next time.